and welcome to New Books in History. My name is Christine Lamberson, and I'll be your host today. Today I'm speaking with Mitchell Roth about his new book out from the University of North Texas Press just this past year in 2016. The book is called Convict Cowboys, The Untold History of the Texas Prison Rodeo. So hello and welcome. Thank you for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me.
So I was wondering if we could start off, if you might tell me a little bit about yourself and about how you came to be a historian, how you came to be a Texan as well.
Well, my career is full of serendipity, I'll put it like that. And I lived in California and decided in my 30s to go to graduate school and become a Western historian. And I was married to another historian at the time, and we both got jobs here at Sam Houston State University. So we moved from Santa Barbara to Huntsville, Texas back in 92. And I started teaching Western history and Texas history, and then I was able to kind of create what was kind of an adjunct situation into a job in the Criminal Justice Department as a historian of criminal justice. And instead of being pigeonholed into just one kind of discipline, like, you know, Western history or whatever, really I could write about anything I wanted to, dealing with the history of criminal justice, but very few people write about it. And while Western history has always been my interest, I've also been interested in Texas history. And so I, living in Huntsville for a while, I started asking questions about, you know, what books were available on this and that. And of course, one of the things that topics that kept coming up was the Texas Prison Rodeo. And that was kind of a piece of East Texas popular culture or tradition for over 50 years. And I found nobody had written a book about it. And, you know, I felt like I would take advantage of, you know, what other archives that we had in the area here. And it seemed like a book that, you know, might have some legs. I've written 16 books and, you know, some of them are successful, some of them aren't. And I just wanted to write something that might reach kind of a broader audience. And this book is, you know, done very well. I've done a lot of book signings around the state and everything, and it was a fun book to write. And and living near the prison museum also, they have a wonderful archives here, and of course in Austin they have a great archives. And I know lots of people, most of the Texas historians I know, so I was very well situated to write this book.
Great. Well, let's dive right in. Do you want to tell us a little bit about what the Texas Prison Rodeo was?
Yeah. So back in the around 1930, obviously the country was in depression, and Texas was, you know, deep in the depression. And back then, the state didn't give any money to the prisoners for medical issues. Like if you needed a new eyeball or a new arm or a new leg or teeth, you had to come up with the money on your own. And the same thing, there wasn't money for education or sports and things like that. So one of the Lee Simmons, who was the superintendent of the prison system at the time, came up with the idea of, you know, just one day. It was like a spur of the moment thing. He talked to a couple other employees and said, why don't we have a prison rodeo? We'll just have, just for the prisoners and the employees and their families. And, you know, it was just kind of like supposed to be like a one and done situation. And pretty soon, you know, people from all over Huntsville came to watch, and had a few hundred people. And so he came up with the idea, well, maybe if we charge for this, we can maybe make some money and put it into the education and recreation fund for the inmates. And so here, you know, they can have some, you know, some good wholesome entertainment and perhaps show the better side of the convicts, you know, riding horses and things like that. So, you know, in a matter of a few years, they had kind of got to the point where, you know, they were getting a few hundred to a few thousand, and then about 10,000-15,000 within 5 years were coming to this. And this is in a town that has about 10,000 or 15,000, you know, free people, you know, outside of the prisons. And by the 1940s and 50s, you know, it was not uncommon for them to have 30,000 people coming to a Sunday performance. So anyway, they had it every Sunday in October. and they did for 50 some years, from 1931 to 1986. And initially, it was supposed to just be, you know, events with the Cowboys involved, and then they kept, you know, jazzing it up by adding new events, adding more dangerous events, bringing in an occasional celebrity like a Tom Mix, the old Western star, and they'd hoped to have a couple other people, but you know, they died before they could come there. Will Rogers, in fact, he had promised to be there in 1935, and he died in a plane crash, which was really unfortunate. But over time, they were bringing a lot of money, and the money was used to refurbish the stands. It was put into, you know, put to use for the inmates. And the inmates all look forward to this. This was probably the first idea that the prison system had, or the superintendent had, that the inmates liked, having a prison rodeo. And so it gave them something to look forward to in October, because if they were well behaved, they're allowed to attend one of the shows. And you know, and over time, as popular culture changed, it kind of moved away from really its southern roots, because it used to have like a lot of kind of minstrel show, and the Cotton Pickers Glee Club was a very popular performance group. But one of the things I think that probably wasn't mentioned that much at the time was in the 1930s. Sports were segregated in Texas, except for the Texas Prison Rodeo, where you had actual black and white performers competing in the same ring, you know, for the same prizes, and you'd see them helping each other up and that sort of thing. And you know, that was, you know, while they had to sit separate in the stands, really the color lines were broken inside the amphitheater, the arena.
So you've touched on a number of things that I wanted to ask you a little bit more about. And so I thought maybe we might start with just talking a little bit about what the rodeo was like for the inmates, for the prisoners. And your book is full of stories of particular individuals and people who are participating and what it's like for them and how they contributed to the development of the rodeo and its change over time. And I was wondering if you might talk a little bit generally about what the experience was like for the prisoners and how this influenced them. And then maybe pick one or two people that you particularly enjoyed researching to talk about their experience.
Well, what was kind of, it was interesting, was for the convicts, got, you know, this was their, you know, one of their rare chances to see free world people, when you had 30,000 people coming. And so the convicts were sitting in their own particular area, the bleachers, watching, but they're probably spending just as much time watching the free world people and kind of imagining, you know, what they're doing when they go home, you know, after it's all over. And, you know, it's kind of vice versa. The free worlders were, you know, kind of, you know, this is a very rare glimpse into the hidden subculture of the prison system. And really, you can see this. It's rooted back, you know, probably 100 years earlier, when they, you know, when prison tourism became kind of a going concern in several prisons around the United States, where people would pay to walk through the prison and just kind of, you know, look at the people. And so, really, this kind of falls into that same, you know, frame of reference, because, you know, I think if this was a regular rodeo, I don't know if they'd be so inclined to go to this. But for the convicts also, you know, it was one of the few places where they could get cheers and they could win enough, you know, a small amount of money in some of the events, but the money went very far in the prison commissary. And so, you know, to them, it was a lot of money that they had a chance of winning. But, you know, getting a medal or getting, you know, the positive feedback was really important for them. And it did a lot for their self-esteem, you know, especially in Texas, being a prisoner is kind of at the bottom, you know, of the barrel for all these people, you know.
So thinking about these experiences, my other question, I guess, was how did some individual prisoners contribute to the rodeo and experiences, especially the people who came to be relatively popular?
Well, what's interesting is some of the biggest winners, in fact, you know, some of the greatest rodeo riders were African American, and they developed their crowds over time. You know, people, you know, that were fans of them, and many of them were African American. I mean, it got to the point in the 1950s that you had reporters from Ebony Magazine coming here and kind of chronicling, you know, the exploits of, you know, some of the riders. And there was one rider who over a period of 40 years won it 7 times. And you know, and his name was O'Neill Browning. And he was probably, you know, the best known of all the convicts. He had an interesting backstory. He had lost a thumb rodeoing when he was a teenager and got in a lot of trouble down the Houston area, you know, with his family. And eventually he ended up killing his father with an axe, and he went to prison. And but he was still able to ride with just one thumb and was one of the greatest. And he was there, you know, well into his 50s. And there was another guy named Willie Craig, also, who, you know, participated. It was very hard for me to find actual, you know, participants, because it's been over 30 years since it ended. And, you know, the people that are in prison, they end up, you know, kind of vanishing in the ether, you know, after, you know, they're finished there. But, you know, really, most of these guys were, you know, felons that were in there. And one of the guys I did speak to was actually there. His name was Glenn Gustafson, and he was there for life for a double murder. And he, you know, he got out eventually, but he was actually a very good writer. He wrote for the prison newspaper, and some of the best accounts of the prison rodeo cowboys, the convict cowboys, were found in the Texas prison newspaper. And, you know, using him kind of as a prism in which to look at the rodeo, you know, was very informative. You know, he hated the prison system, so, you know, had to, you know, take with a grain of salt everything he, you know, said. But I was able to, you know, kind of, you know, find that most of what he said was, you know, pretty realistic. I mean, he was there when John Wayne came, mm-hmm. and John Wayne, he said, was drunk. And I found some letters written between a couple of other people here who reported that John Wayne was drunk when he was here. And one of the things he pointed out was that he wouldn't shake hands with the prisoners, which I thought was kind of interesting. But on the other hand, the entertainers were all paid through the prisoner welfare fund. And so John Wayne, when he found out it would come out of the prisoner's pockets, he said he didn't want to be paid. And so he was one of the few celebrities that came to say hi that didn't get paid. So, you know, as far as the, you know, actual individual cowboys, I think what's just as interesting as the convict cowboys are the strange events that they added to kind of, you know, bring the rodeo into the 20th century. And they would do crazy things like right after World War II, there were a couple of prisoners that were in jail for forgery, and they'd been paratroopers during World War II. And they offered to jump out of a plane from about 1,500 feet up and land in the middle of the arena. And so the first year you had one of these guys doing this, and all 4 Sundays he did it, and all 4 Sundays he missed the arena, ending up in trees, on cars, in the cemetery. It was humorous, you know. He didn't get hurt. And then the following year, another guy tried to, you know, he offered to do the same thing with the same criminal background, and he was even worse. He one time he opened his chute open while he was inside the plane. He couldn't even get out. So it was you know, kind of wacky. And then they have, you know, this woman Marilyn Rich, the helicopter girl, doing tricks underneath a helicopter, and really all this stuff had nothing to do with the rodeo. And, you know, people, you know, on the inside, you know, were just doing it, you know, just trying to come up with ways to, you know, drum up attendance. So they'd always ratchet it up. I mean, if there was no injuries, they would tell the guys to use like a packet of ketchup to, you know, for some fake blood. But a lot of the events were really crazy, and you would never find them in a regular rodeo. They actually served no, you know, ranching purpose whatsoever. They had, you know, at one time in the 30s, they had a guy riding a buffalo, of all things. You had guys standing on their head and having horses jump from between their legs. It was almost like they were showing off. And, you know, and the female prisoners were allowed to come attendant as well, even though they weren't allowed to perform until the 1970s. And they were allowed to dress up in very nice outfits rather, you know, than the prison garb. So mm-hmm. There's a picture of that in the book.
Yeah, that's great. Since you talked a little bit about injuries and these sort of, more and more elaborate sorts of events and things like that, I was wondering if you might talk, thinking a little bit about the appeal of going to the prison rodeo as a spectator. You talk a little bit about the fact that there are numerous injuries and accidents over the period of time. You say that only one person died during the actual rodeo over its lifespan. But I was wondering if you might talk a little bit about how that danger factor kind of fits in. You already talked a little bit about how part of this is sort of prison tourism, but a little bit more about that appeal from a spectator standpoint.
Well, I think for a lot of people, it's kind of like people that go to car races. Hoping to see, they might not say it, but they wouldn't be disappointed if there was a car wreck or something like that. Or just like, anybody who's driving down the highway and you see a car wreck, you want to stop and watch. And so I think there was that violent nature of it. And also, too, there was a lot of this phony hearkening to the Western frontier as well. A lot of that was used, whereas really East Texas was never really part of the frontier experience, but it was very easy to manipulate history and manipulate the knowledge of the people that went to this. They would pretend like this is the way it was in the West, and rather I think it was either Louis L'Amour or something, this is the West as it should have been, rather than really how it was. And even places like Dallas, which have tried to borrow the Western ethos and the cattle, the cattle trails and stuff, really wasn't part of the West either. But it's a big selling tool, because really, if you look at most popular American icons, probably the cowboy. And so, looking at the development of the Texas prison rodeo, and looking at its antecedents going back to the Wild West shows, and the amateur rodeo events in the 19th century, you can see the interest, I think, it didn't change. It was people trying to look at the past, and living in kind of a dull present. And if you look at really the halcyon years of the rodeo, were kind of in the 50s, when all the Western TV shows were on. They were very popular, and and it said something about American culture. It was kind of a culture of conformity, and to many people, the prisoners and the cowboys, they were all kind of outsiders. So I think there was a lot of borrowing this narrative, the individual, the person who's outside of society, and it all comes together in the rodeo ring.
Interesting. So I want to talk a little bit about how the rodeo changes over time. But before we do that, one of the things that's really striking about your book and hearing you talk as well is that in a lot of ways, the Texas prison rodeo seems like a pretty positive story. And, there are lots of new books by historians about prisons coming out at the moment. You talk about some of that in your book as well. There's certainly lots of news articles about prisons. And generally speaking, that's not an era of positivity. That's not a positive story most of the time. And the prison rodeo is starting at a time when the Texas prison system is brutal in many ways. Prison farms are really terrible places to be. There's lots of brutality. There's lots of segregation. There's lots of racism, etc.
Sure.
And so I was wondering if you might talk a little bit about how this story fits into that larger narrative of prison history and into the system that in many ways is a system of brutality and not a positive story in other realms.
I think that this is kind of a bookend to that. If you look at the prison system in Texas in the 1930s, it was universally known as one of the worst, most brutal prison systems. But in the 40s and 50s, they began to modernize under some new superintendents and that sort of thing, and they began to try to move into the 20th century. But the bottom line is that they weren't getting any money from the state, because you didn't have a lot of public support for spending money on prisons. And even today, there's not a lot of support for that. You know, prisoners used to be able to get Pell Grants and get educated in prisons. And I'd hear prison guards complaining, well, I have to pay for mine. Why should they get it for free? You know, that sort of thing. Not thinking of the long term, you know, problem of having people unprepared for the free world. But, you know, I think for the prison system, too, this was they're putting their best foot forward by this Texas prison rodeo. You have, you know, TV and, you know, all the different media would cover it, you know, from that era. And, you know, and like you said, it was a very positive thing. You didn't have PETA back then, for instance. And there were several other prison rodeos as well around the United States, you know, over time. But this was the first one. And, you know, it's kind of interesting that, you know, that they would have it in a really a non-Western state. Although, you know, you have people kind of the urban cowboy, fad that was big in East Texas and then spread across the country. And of course, the urban cowboy was, you know, partly filmed, you know, at the prison rodeo. Mm-hmm. But the thing is that this was something, a rare positive impression that could be given to the public. And they bought it hook, line, and sinker. And they were very media savvy at, you know, basically showing the best side of the prison system come October Sundays.
Mm-hmm. So were there criticisms of the prison rodeo along the way?
Yeah, well, there were. The biggest criticism actually came from the religious community. And it's kind of interesting is when Huntsville's a place with, you know, more churches than bars and that sort of thing. And when they first started it in 1931, Lee Simmons went around to all the congregations and asked for permission to have a Sunday prison rodeo. And they had plenty of support from the community. But by the 1940s, the Baptists were, you know, getting energized, you know, against, number one, having prisoners being involved in some type of, you know, public forum. And number two, having it done on Sundays. You know, of course, they ignored the fact that football is played on Sunday and a lot of other sports, and even hunting takes place on Sunday. But, you know, I found all kinds of letters to the prison system from different groups in Palestine and places like that, and Pasadena, just, you know, complaining about this. And so the thing is the prison system reacted by 1 year changing the date to Saturday. Then another year they tried having one during the week and one on the weekend, but nothing ever worked as well as Sundays because that's when everybody's off. And they were able to basically respond to the religious community by telling them that this is a very religious thing to do for these people, that it really is, you know, doing the Lord's work, kind of. There's a certain amount of forgiveness and all of that, you know, implicit in having this Sunday prison rodeo. So they never really moved away from that. But that was the biggest criticism came from that. And then, you know, as you moved into the 1960s and 70s, you know, time period of the writ riders and things like that, and Texas was the target of, you know, federal lawsuits. And you know, a lot of the focus, you know, was, you know, off of the Texas prison rodeo. And it really, you know, it kind of outlived its use, because by the 70s and 80s, 60s and 70s, Austin was giving them money for the same things they were raising money for, you know, as far as medical and educational care and things like that. So they didn't need to raise the money the way they used to. And also, I think it lasted as long as it did because of a lot of creative bookkeeping, making it seem like it was making more money than it actually was. And in reality, it was, you know, losing money. And, you know, they tried saving money by, you know, getting rid of having the Western stars coming and, you know, saying hi in the middle of the ring, or Frankie Avalon, or Candy Bar the stripper. They did that for a while, and then they stopped it in the 70s, and they saw nobody would come. Because anybody can go to a rodeo, but, you know, how many people can go to a rodeo and see Steve McQueen or John Wayne or Willie Nelson or Johnny Cash? So the problem, too, by that time period is that it was getting too expensive to pay these stars. You know, they used to be able to afford it. So you know, the modern world was starting to infringe on the rodeo era. And also, too, I think there was a criticism from people in Huntsville because, you know, by the 60s, there was a lot of complaints about parking problems and, you know, kind of theft and just, you know, Huntsvillians didn't want to be kind of identified as part of, the Texas, the prison system, you know, this being the main event. And there were people actually saying, well, we can make as much money having football games here and this and that, and which is a joke also, because no one was going to come, you know, to Huntsville for these types of events. But I think it was kind of a perfect storm to a certain extent of, the depression and this idea of, ways to make money and entertain the public and give the prisoners, you know, this help. You know, the prisoners were really well behaved. If you think of the thousands that went to these things and the opportunities for escaping or fighting or whatever. And for the most part, they policed each other because they knew that, you know, they would only have the prison rodeo as long as the prisoners weren't a problem. And there was a lot of, the prisoners all kind of supported each other, and even those that didn't ride, if someone that couldn't afford their own boots or their own chaps or whatever, they had leather goods makers that would make them for them. There was kind of an esprit de corps among the prisoners that, you know, you really aren't used to seeing, especially, you know, in the gang culture in the prisons today. But back then, the prison culture was very different. And by the 70s and 80s, the prison culture was changing as well.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So were there other aspects of how the rodeo changed over time?
In the 70s when they brought in the women, looking at it from a gender perspective, it was kind of demeaning the events that they had for the women, things like chasing greased pigs and things like that. And they only had the women involved as long as the female prison was located real close. And then when it moved to Gatesville, which is far away, the women stopped performing. So the only women you saw in the prison rodeo were like on the quadrille teams and, you know, doing trick riding and that sort of thing. It's interesting too. I found, that women were very much involved in the original rodeos, in the early, 20th century. They did a lot of the events, that the men did. But a woman was killed in doing one of the, bull riding events or wild horse riding events. But the Rodeo Association changed the rules, keeping women away from this. And then the same thing happened in the Olympics. There used to be some horse events for women in the Olympics, and they got rid of those as well because they didn't think it was, you know, feminine enough or safe enough and that sort of thing. So, you know, there's a lot of interesting gender issues, you know, looking at, the female involvement in the Texas prison rodeo.
Mm-hmm. So I'm curious, thinking about, you know, why the rodeo comes to an end when it does in 1986. I mean, a lot of the factors that you're talking about are sort of big cultural changes and structural changes happening in prisons and whatnot. And of course, the Angola Penitentiary in Louisiana still has a prison rodeo.
Right.
And I was curious if you might talk a little bit about kind of the ending of the Texas prison rodeo in the context of the larger landscape of prison rodeos and just that so to speak.
Yeah, I think, in the 1980s, I think the biggest problem is when everybody on the Texas prison board realized that they could be sued in court. The prisoners had become much more litigious, by then, especially with the writ writers and, a lot of the problems within the prison system. But also, they could never get enough insurance that would really protect them the way they wanted to be protected. So you combine that with the rodeo not making any money And there really weren't a whole lot of there wasn't a lot of support for keeping it around. They tried raising money in the Huntsville area, getting different merchants to, you know, kick in money. They needed $800,000, they said, to fix the stadium as it was falling apart. But that was kind of just an excuse because it took them 12 years to tear the stadium down. And they were only able to raise a few $100s. So that itself demonstrated that, you know, that the local population really wasn't that interested in continuing, you know, the experience. So you have that. And also, too, the sensibilities were starting to change. You know, animal rights people, you had, you know, the rising problems with gangs, you know, and, you know, after the prisons were desegregated, you had, you know, kind of a rise in gang membership and that sort of thing. So, you know, just the era was changing and the sensibilities were changing. You know, I mean, there were so many other things for people to do at that point, even though, you know, the computer world was yet to come. You know, you had a lot more outlets for entertainment by the 1980s.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Also, another thing I probably should have touched on also was you didn't have that many people with any rodeo skills as well.
I mean,
most of the, you know, I mean, even early on, they used to like to say in the rodeo promotional material that these guys had all been riders out on the ranges and this and that. And I went through the prison archives looking at you, because when you go into prison, you know, they write down what your profession was. And there were actually more actors in prison in the 30s than there were rodeo performers. So there really weren't that many, but they were, you know, generally more familiar with livestock and the ranching way of life in the 30s and 40s and 50s. And then as time goes on, you know, they're more likely to be guys that, you know, robbed a 7-Eleven and had the only horse they'd ever seen was on TV. So obviously it was going to become much more dangerous for them to, you know, to perform, and maybe they wouldn't be as good.
So what does this book tell us about criminal justice in Texas and how it's changed over time and how the prison system has changed over time and also just how things have changed for inmates over the course of the story?
Well, I think what the book demonstrates is the evolution of the prison system, and I made sure to keep that as the backdrop to the actual prison rodeo itself. You know, as it moved from a mostly an agricultural based prison system, you know, to one that was a lot more modern. And, you know, at the time when it was the agricultural, I mean, the guys that ran the wardens that ran the different, you know, prisons, you know, it was their own, like, feudal states, and they could really get away with anything. And, you know, a lot of this, you know, was taking place out in rural areas where no one saw it and no one found out about it until, you know, in the 1940s, you started to have these commissions that were coming around and, you know, insisting that, you know, things get changed. And of course, you had some modern superintendents come in, like George Beto, that really, you know, moved the prison system forward. And, you know, incidentally, he didn't even like rodeos. He said once he wouldn't walk across the street to go to a rodeo. And his wife probably hated him more because on rodeo Sundays, you know, all the visiting dignitaries and, you know, people that were here, they would come over to the house, and people, you know, rodeo guys that needed something sewn or whatever, they would come over. And so she would always check the year before the rodeo started in October to see if it was going to be on 4 Sundays or 5 Sundays. And that was very important to her, you know, because she really didn't care for it. But, you know, you know, the Texas prison system is, you know, often, you know, been, you know, the target of, you know, prison reform, you know, throughout its history. And even today, you know, it's still a target for reform. You know, it's got, you know, they have fans at the out in the farms so the pigs don't get hot. And, you know, there's no air conditioning in the prison cells in Huntsville, you know, in the summer, you know, when it's 100 degrees. So, you know, as far as looking at it as, you know, what does it say about the prison, about the American, you know, system, you know, of prisons or whatever? Well, you know, the Texas prison system and the California prison system are two of the, you know, the largest, the two largest prison systems in the country. And, you know, so go those prison systems, so goes America. And you had very few, you know, positive experiences for, you know, convicts when they were in prison, you know, because there wasn't any money for them. And this gave them that outlook. And in many respects, it kept violence down in the prison system, you know, at the time. I think the prisoners, you know, got along a lot better. But, you know, as I said, the writ writers like was it Rodriguez?
Yeah.
You know, that the different writ writers that, you know, changed like the prison tender system. There used to be a prison tender system where you had trustees that had the power of prison guards that were inside the prisons, basically making sure everybody behaved. And, of course, once this was outlawed, you had a vacuum of power in the prisons, and that's where the gangs moved in, which is a whole nother story. But I think a lot of it has to do with, in Texas, with co-opting the Western myth, mm-hmm. rather, and trying to distance itself away from the Southern myth, because the Western myth is a lot more palatable, you know, than the Southern, you know, the Southern culture. When you look at the plantations and slavery and that sort of thing, you know, you don't want to relive that. But the West, as it ought to be, it was an experience many more people had a deep attachment to. That's as American as you can get. But in reality, slavery was as American as you could get. Also, with the same, you know, when that was in session.
Absolutely. So how do you think the Texas prison rodeo is going to be kind of part of historical memory? I'm curious, just kind of thinking about this, you know, the Western ethos. And also, you, of course, start by talking a little bit about the rodeo's relationship to prison tourism and how it's sort of a part of that. But prison tourism, I was just not that long ago reading, a story about prison tourism, in fact, in Huntsville, and it's something that certainly people still have an interest in. So I was curious if you had any thoughts about where this is going to come down on that historical memory.
Well, for one thing, the prison system in Texas has gotten a lot more sensitive to outside opinion. And I think, you know, the prisons are much more closed off to, the outside public than they used to be. Or, you know, you really have to have a reason to be in a prison now rather than going to watch an event there or tour the prison. So, that's very important, you know, because of, you know, public opinion. Where were we going with this?
Well, I was curious sort of how these enter historical memory. How you might think about Texas prison rodeo?
Well, I think it's fading. It's really fading in Texas, and that's why it was also a very timely book for me to do, because the kids don't care about rodeo now, and rodeo, if anything, has gotten a bad rap because of animal cruelty and things like that, and so people, that remember it kind of remember that it's almost like the West remembering it as it should have been. I think people remembering the rodeo as it should have been, I've gone to some of the reunions of old, prison guards and people that were involved in the prison rodeo. And, when you hear them talk about it, they have, a lot of, really good memories about it. But in reality, they just have their particular memory of it. They don't, see the overall picture. And so I thought it was important, while I could still, find somebody I could talk to and talk to people that had been there to bring it to life, that this was the right time to do it. And, and that's kind of why it happened.
Great. So one last question on that front, since you just mentioned talking to people, what sort of research did you do for this book? I mean, you mentioned a little bit in the book itself, and just generally, of course, doing research on prisons, on prisoners, on anything that's kind of going on in that realm can be very difficult. So how did you discover the story, or how did you really unveil the details of it?
Well, what I did is I went over to Austin, and where they keep all of the prison records. And so I went through the meetings of the board of the prison board meetings over about a 60-year period, and to find out what they said about the rodeo and why they were having it. What were the people in the inner circle talking about? This is the place to find that. And then I found some collections of letters written, between people that, you know, were in charge of the prison rodeo and others that gave you kind of some insight as well. So I did a lot of newspaper research, but it was covered all over. It was even in Hollywood, they would say who was going to be in the Texas prison rodeo this year and that sort of thing in the Variety magazine, where they talk about the movie business. So, I looked everywhere, and I'm a pretty good researcher, and you know, I think I found, you know, every piece of archival material that I could find. The only thing I was disappointed in was not finding really any convict cowboys to talk to. I found lots of employees that worked there. Mm-hmm. But I think, you know, people just want to forget that, or, you know, 30 years ago, you know, is a long time in the life of a Texas convict.
Yeah, absolutely.
But fortunately, there was a lot of material that I was able to use, and I had a sabbatical one semester. And my problem is I'm usually working on a couple books at the same time, so, mm-hmm. you know, so that's always a problem.
Well, it's a very well-researched book. I enjoyed reading it.
I appreciate that.
So, given that you're working on quite a few books at the same time, what are you working on now?
Well, I have like four book contracts, and the book I'm working on the most, I don't have a contract on. It's probably going to be with the University of Ohio Press, but I'm writing a book on the worst prison disaster in American history, which was the Ohio prison fire in 1930 that killed 320 inmates. Right. And nobody's ever written kind of a comprehensive book on it or a well-researched. And, you know, I've been working on it off and on for, you know, about 5 years. And I've come into, you know, several unpublished memoirs of, you know, or diaries of people that survived it. And I deal with a lot of other issues, too. But really, the 1930s was the first big era of prison overcrowding in the United States. And so I deal with a lot of other issues besides just the fire. I mean, the fire, people were dead within an hour because they died of suffocation. But the story of why they died, how they died, I think is an important story and has relevance for today.
Great. Well, that sounds like a great book. Hopefully, maybe we'll have you back on.
Well, I appreciate it. It's fun. So I'm writing it right now. So hopefully I'll finish it within the year. And then I'm also working on a book on the world's prison gangs. So all around the world. And a lot of its history. And I start out with the Italian Camorra in the prisons in Naples and work my way forward. So anyway, those are some of the main things I'm working on right now.
Well, that would sound great. Well, thank you so much for joining us today to talk about convict cowboys.
Okay. Well, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.